you know, usually when you walk into a brand new, highly engineered building, there's this basic expectation of solidity.
Right. You assume the floors are concrete.
Exactly. You assume the walls are load bearing and, you know, the locks on the doors actually do their job.
You'd certainly hope so.
But looking at the stack of tech and gaming briefs that hit our desks this morning, which for the record is Tuesday, July 28, 2026, I realized something really unsettling.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The digital floors we're all standing on are, well, they're basically just painted cardboard.
It is a really comforting assumption. I mean, believing the structures we inhabit are built exactly the way they appear to be built.
Totally.
But the sources we're looking at today, they just strip that facade away entirely. We're dealing with this massive collection of incidents.
Spanning, like, everything.
Right. AI privacy breaches, gaming infrastructure meltdowns, and corporate cryptocurrency strategies.
Which sound completely disconnected at first.
They do, but they actually all point to one singular inescapable pattern. The hidden costs of convenience.
And the illusion of control. There is just this canyon-sized gap between how we think our digital systems function and what is actually happening under the hood.
It's a massive gap.
So our mission for today's deep dive is to explore that gap because, frankly, reading through this stuff kind of shattered my illusion of how much control we actually have as users.
I think it will shatter it for a lot of people.
Okay, let's unpack this by starting with the spaces you probably assume are the most private, right?
Yeah.
Your personal AI chats.
Ah, yes. The Claude situation.
Right. Between July 25th and 27th, users suddenly discovered that their highly sensitive Claude AI conversations were just, like, sitting there, fully visible.
On Google and Bing search results.
Yes. We're talking medical information, yeah. Internal corporate planning documents, even unreleased academic research, all just out in the open.
And, you know, on the surface, that sounds like Anthropic, the company behind Claude, suffered this catastrophic server hack.
Like they leaked a directory of private chats or something.
Exactly. But what's fascinating here is that this isn't a security flaw at all. It represents a much deeper failure in human-computer interaction.
Because Anthropic didn't actually hand anything over to Google.
No, they didn't.
The users themselves clicked a button that says share. Now, if you are listening to this, think about what the word share means to you in an app.
Usually it's pretty contained.
Right. When I click share on a photo on my phone, it opens a menu to, like, text it to my mom or drop it to a friend's device.
It creates a private, temporary bridge between you and someone you trust.
Exactly. But in Claude's interface, clicking share just generated a public URL. And users then took those URLs and posted them on Reddit or Twitter or public Discord servers.
Thinking they were just showing a snippet to a friend.
Yeah. It's like whispering a deeply personal secret into a microphone that you don't realize is secretly wired to a stadium PA system. And then being shocked when the stadium speakers amplify it to 50,000 people.
The disconnect really stems from how search engines actually operate. People assume a link is a gated tunnel.
And it's not.
It's absolutely not. The moment you paste a URL into any public forum, Google's web crawlers, these automated bots that are just constantly scanning the internet for new content, they find that link.
Because that's literally their only job.
Right. A crawler's entire purpose is to follow links, read the text on the destination page, and index it for search results.
And because Anthropic designed those shared URLs to be accessible without any sort of, like, authentication.
Yes. No password required. So the crawler just reads your private medical queries exactly like it would read a public Wikipedia page.
But wait, why would a tech company design it that way in the first place? Why not just add a simple password prompt or, I don't know, require the person opening the link to be logged into an authorized account? Kind of like how a Google Doc works.
It really comes down to the philosophy of user friction.
Okay.
Tech companies are obsessed with frictionless sharing because it drives viral growth.
Right. If it's hard to share, people just won't do it.
Exactly. If I send you a cool AI prompt and you have to create an account or enter a password just to see it, you might just close the tab. Anthropic chose frictionless accessibility over default privacy.
And their response to this incident was essentially, hey, these links are long strings of random characters. They aren't guessable.
Which is such a massive deflection.
Totally. Nobody is sitting at home manually guessing a 50-character URL.
Precisely the problem. Security through obscurity isn't security at all. The interface makes the act of sharing feel casual and, you know, intimate.
But the underlying code executes an action that is permanent.
And far-reaching. The internet doesn't understand context or intimacy. It only understands access permissions.
Wow. So we have this situation where our private truths are accidentally being pushed into the public sphere just because of terrible UI assumptions.
Yeah, that's one side of the coin.
But if we flip the coin, we're currently seeing fabricated lies forcefully pushed into our feeds on purpose.
The GTA 6 situation.
Oh, man. If you've been anywhere near gaming social media this week, you know the Grand Theft Auto 6 community is in a full-blown crisis.
The sheer influx of generative AI content is, well, it's fascinating to watch from a sociological perspective.
Though I imagine it's incredibly frustrating for the actual fans.
Frustrating doesn't even cover it.
Right, because fans are practically starving for official gameplay footage before November. And content creators are heavily exploiting that desperation.
It's a gold rush for fake content.
It is. There's been this massive flood of AI-generated GTA 6 gameplay videos featuring the expected protagonists, you know, Lucia and Jason.
And they look just real enough at a quick glance on a phone screen.
Exactly. And these aren't just sitting in obscure forums. They're racking up millions of views on Instagram and TikTok. It actually got to the point where on July 25th, Take-Two Interactive launched a massive copyright takedown campaign.
Targeting the big channels, pushing the fake content, right? Yeah. Like Vice Nation.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd argue the takedowns are just a relentless game of whack-a-mole, though. You really have to look at the economic incentives driving this behavior to understand why it just won't stop.
Oh, the math on this is just wild. Our sources broke down the return on investment. And, I mean, it makes complete sense why people are doing this.
The margins are huge.
Insane. To generate one of these fake videos using tools like Runway or Pika, a creator spends maybe $5 to $10 in compute credits.
Right.
But if they land a viral hit on YouTube Shorts or TikTok, the ad revenue payout is between $500 and $2,000.
Which is a staggering return.
So if someone spends a couple of hours and $50 making 10 fake videos, and just two of them catch the algorithm's attention, they could walk away with 10 grand.
And that phrase, catch the algorithm's attention, that is the critical mechanism here. The algorithms running these platforms are entirely agnostic to truth.
They don't care if it's real.
They do not care at all if a video is a handcrafted masterpiece or a cheap AI hallucination. They only measure engagement, watch time, clicks, shares, and comments.
Even if the comments are just thousands of people angrily yelling, "This is fake AI trash."
Especially then, rage and correction are extremely high-value engagement metrics.
Wow.
The algorithm sees a flurry of activity and decides, hey, people are interacting with this. Let's show it to a million more people.
That is so messed up.
It feeds directly into this concept some theorists call the dead internet theory.
Where it's just bots talking to bots.
Basically. Eventually, automated systems are just feeding algorithmically generated slop to other automated bots and exhausted humans, completely drowning out actual reality.
And the irony here is just thick.
Hmm?
Rockstar's CEO, Strauss Zelnick, is on record promising that GTA 6 will be a 100% handcrafted experience.
He was very adamant about that.
Right. He made a massive point that there was absolutely no generative AI used in the core development of their world.
And yet,
because of how our social media feeds function, the most visible, prominent marketing the game is currently receiving is algorithm-optimized, 100% AI-generated slop.
It perfectly illustrates the tension of modern media. You have painstakingly slow, human-driven creation on one side, and frictionless, machine-driven distribution on the other.
Wow.
We assume our feeds curate authenticity, but they really only optimize for attention.
Okay, so if the open web is fundamentally compromised, whether by bad UI exposing our secrets or algorithms rewarding fake content, surely the curated closed ecosystems are safe.
Wait,
right?
You would hope so.
Right, like if you stay inside a walled garden where content is heavily moderated, you should be protected.
I really wish that were true. But looking at the Mecha malware campaign, that assumption of safety is actually the very thing attackers are weaponizing against you.
This story genuinely gave me chills. So researchers just discovered a highly sophisticated malware operation hiding inside custom maps on the Steam Workshop.
A place gamers trust implicitly.
Exactly. Yeah. It's been targeting Counter-Strike 2, Dota 2, and Garry's Mod since at least December 2024. And it's racked up over 50,000 downloads.
That we know of.
Right. And once it's on your machine, it secretly mines a cryptocurrency called Monero using your GPU, and it quietly steals your browser passwords and Steam credentials.
The technical execution of Mecha is really what makes it so dangerous. Usually, malware relies on tricking you into running an executable file, like a .x.
Like clicking a sketchy email attachment.
Exactly. But here, when a user downloads a custom map, the map itself works perfectly. You can load it up, practice your aim, play with friends.
So you have no idea anything is wrong.
None. But embedded within the game's actual files is a malicious payload that utilizes a technique called process hollowing, or in-memory execution.
Okay, hold on. Wait, explain process hollowing. Because if I have an expensive antivirus suite running on my gaming PC, shouldn't it catch malicious code?
You would definitely think so. But traditional antivirus primarily scans static files on your hard drive looking for known bad signatures.
Okay.
Mecha bypasses this by injecting its malicious code directly into the active running memory space, the RAM of the game itself.
Oh, wow.
So to your antivirus, it doesn't see a virus. It just sees Counter-Strike 2 doing normal, complex math.
And that math just happens to be mining Monero.
Exactly.
Why Monero, by the way? Everyone always talks about Bitcoin. Why are hackers obsessed with Monero?
It's all about stealth. Bitcoin requires highly specialized, incredibly loud machines called ASICs to mine efficiently.
Right, those massive server farms.
Yes. Monero, on the other hand, uses an algorithm specifically designed to run efficiently on standard consumer CPUs and GPUs.
I see.
So if you are a hacker trying to secretly hijack a gamer's high-end graphics card, Monero is the most profitable and untraceable way to do it.
But I still want to push back on how this even gets to the player. Valve heavily moderates the Steam Workshop, right? The community reports bad stuff.
They do, yes.
If you are playing CS2 and you want to get better, you don't go to some shady pirate site. You download a highly rated training map straight from the official platform. How are players supposed to protect themselves if the heavily guarded infrastructure itself is delivering the threat?
They almost can't. And that is the terrifying brilliance of the attack.
It's so messed up.
The malware authors masterfully exploited the psychology of the competitive gamer. They know you are desperate for an edge. They didn't need to hack Valve's central servers with some complex zero-day exploit.
They just needed a good map.
They just needed to hack the player's assumption that curated means safe. Community trust is basically the ultimate unpatchable attack vector.
It makes you wonder how much control these platform holders actually have over their own ecosystems. I mean, if Valve can't keep malware out of their walled garden, what hope does a company have of keeping their own corporate secrets inside one?
Which brings us perfectly to Nintendo.
Yes. The ESRB leak.
It's a perfect transition from malicious actors exploiting a platform to the sheer impossibility of maintaining secrecy in a modern global supply chain.
I have to admit, watching the Reddit community decode this leak over the weekend was incredible.
They work fast.
They really do. So here's what happened. A game called Lego Party accidentally popped up on the ESRB rating board. But it wasn't listed for the PlayStation or the Xbox or the Switch.
It was listed under the platform code NSWC.
Right. A hardware identifier that just doesn't exist in any official public capacity.
But the community immediately went to work.
They did. NSW was the internal code for the original Nintendo Switch. Keeping that acronym heavily implies the new console will have backward compatibility with the old one.
Which is huge news for fans.
Massive. And that C. The consensus is that it stands for console, which suggests there will be multiple SKUs.
And for anyone unfamiliar with retail logistics, a SKU is a stock-keeping unit, basically a distinct version of a product.
Right.
If there is a specific console SKU, it heavily implies the existence of a separate SKU, perhaps a cheaper, handheld-only, light version.
Exactly. Plus, getting an ESRB rating in July 2026 perfectly aligns with the manufacturing timelines for a Q1 2027 launch window.
The timeline fits perfectly.
But part of me wonders, doesn't this just build hype? I mean, isn't a leak like this almost good for Nintendo? It gets everyone talking about the Switch 2 without them having to spend a single dime on marketing.
I would strongly argue the opposite, actually.
Really?
Yes. For a company like Nintendo, controlled marketing cadences are everything. And you only have to look back at the Wii U to understand why.
Oh, man. The Wii U disaster?
Exactly. When the Wii U was announced, the messaging was incredibly muddy. Because of how it was revealed, a massive portion of the casual gaming audience thought the new console was just an expensive tablet accessory for their existing Nintendo Wii.
Right, they thought it was just a controller.
they didn't realize it was an entirely new next-generation system, and that confusion completely kneecapped the console's sales for its entire lifespan.
Because they lost control of the narrative.
Yes. When a massive hardware launch leaks through a rating board, it strips the company of their ability to explain what the product actually is.
And keeping it secret is just functionally impossible today anyway.
Right. Think about the sheer scale of a modern video game release. You have third-party publishers like Warner Bros., building the Lego game, you have international rating boards, localization teams, translating text, marketing agencies, global manufacturers.
But thousands of people.
Nintendo's real challenge isn't plugging the leaks. The ship is already leaking from 50 different holes. Their challenge is accepting that the ecosystem is just too big to be a walled garden anymore.
So what does this all mean? If we pull all these threads together, losing privacy to bad UI, losing truth to algorithms, losing security to trusted platforms, and losing secrets to supply chains, it feels like this overarching loss of control ties directly into a loss of actual ownership.
I agree completely.
We think we own our digital lives, but really we just rent them from incredibly fragile cloud servers.
And there is no better or more painful example of that fragility than the 20-hour Xbox infrastructure outage on July 27th.
That was brutal. Millions of players globally were just completely locked out of their digital game libraries for nearly a full day.
Just unable to play games they paid for.
And the crazy part is, this wasn't even a malicious hack. Microsoft's CTO, Scott Van Vliet, came out and gave a surprisingly transparent technical breakdown. It was a cascading failure in an outsourced licensing service.
And that single failure cost Microsoft an estimated $10 to $20 million in lost revenue.
Van Vliet's transparency was refreshing compared to standard corporate PR, for sure.
It was, but if we connect this to the bigger picture, the mechanics of the failure highlight a terrifying architectural flaw in modern entertainment.
Let's talk about that.
Let's look at how digital rights management, or DRM, actually functions in a cloud-based world.
Just like, imagine you buy a brand new $70,000 house. You own the deed, your furniture's inside, your clothes are in the closet.
Right.
But the front door relies on a cloud-connected smart lock. And every time you turn the handle, that lock sends a ping to a server 1,000 miles away to verify you're allowed inside.
And if that server goes down?
If that remote server goes down, the digital token never arrives and you are left standing on your own front porch in the rain, staring through the window at a house you paid for, completely unable to get inside.
That analogy hits the nail on the head.
It's so frustrating.
In the physical media era, if Xbox Live went down, you just put your disc in the console and played your game offline. The verification of ownership was physical. It happened locally in your living room.
But today?
Today, the shift to cloud infrastructure has created a catastrophic single point of failure. The convenience of downloading a game instantly, of moving your library from one console to another without carrying discs, it has fundamentally cost you the permanence of actually owning your media.
It is just wild to think about. But right. This brings up a really fascinating contrast with our final story. Because while everyday consumers are finding themselves trapped by the fragility of centralized servers failing, we're seeing massive corporate entities pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into decentralized networks to actively regain their control.
Yes.
Let's talk about the crypto moves Bitmain is making.
This is a significant indicator of how corporate treasuries are evolving their view on digital assets. They aren't just hoarding cash anymore.
Right. So according to our sources, Bitmain just bought another 10,000 Ethereum. They spent $33.9 million, which averages out to about $3,390 per token.
That's a massive purchase.
It is. And this brings their total corporate treasury holding to 40,000 ETH, which is roughly $135.6 million.
Yeah.
Now, I have to admit, I'm a little confused by this strategy.
Why is that?
Well, whenever we hear about corporate crypto adoption, everyone always talks about Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin is digital gold, the ultimate store of value. Why is a massive corporation pouring $130 million into which is basically the digital silver?
Because Bitmain isn't looking for a static store of value to just sit in a vault. They are looking for a productive asset.
Okay.
Bitcoin is fantastic for scarcity, but Ethereum offers programmability and utility through smart contracts.
Unpack smart contracts for me, because that term gets thrown around a lot.
Sure. Think of a smart contract like a digital vending machine.
A vending machine.
Yeah. With a regular contract, you need a lawyer or a bank to enforce the rules. With a smart contract, the rules are written directly into the code.
Oh.
If I put in a dollar and press the button for a soda, the machine automatically dispenses it. No middleman required. Ethereum is essentially a global, decentralized computer that runs millions of these vending machines, handling complex financial transactions automatically.
Okay, so they're investing in the underlying infrastructure of decentralized finance. But how does that make the asset productive for Bitmain's treasury?
Through a mechanism called proof of stake. This is where Ethereum drastically differs from Bitcoin.
Right, Bitcoin relies on mining.
Exactly. Bitcoin uses proof of work, meaning miners burn massive amounts of electricity solving math puzzles to secure the network and earn new coins. Ethereum shifted to proof of stake. Instead of burning electricity, participants secure the network by locking up or staking their own Ethereum as collateral.
Wait, I'm lost. How does locking up a digital token actually secure anything? That sounds like financial magic.
It's based on game theory and financial penalties. When you stake your Ethereum, you are basically volunteering to run software that verifies transactions on the network.
Okay, I'll follow that.
If you verify honest transactions, the network rewards you with a small yield newly generated Ethereum. But if you try to cheat the system or verify fraudulent transactions, the network automatically confiscates your locked up collateral.
Oh, wow.
It's called slashing. The security comes from the fact that it is financially ruinous to attack the network.
Oh, I see. So because Bitmain is holding 40,000 ETH, they can stake it and earn that yield.
Exactly. Right now, that staking yield is about 3 to 4% annually.
Okay.
So on a $135 million position, Bitmain is generating between $4 and $5.4 million a year just for holding and staking the asset.
That's incredible.
It acts much more like a dividend-paying tech stock or a high-yield bond than a static piece of gold.
What's also really interesting is the mechanics of how they are accumulating this much Ethereum. I mean, they aren't just logging onto an exchange and dumping $30 million into the market in one giant click, hoping they time the bottom perfectly.
No, they are utilizing a strict strategy called dollar cost averaging, or DCA.
Right.
Instead of trying to time the market, which is essentially impossible, they buy smaller fixed dollar amounts at regular intervals. Maybe they buy $1 million every Monday, regardless of whether the price is slightly up or slightly down.
Because that smooths out the volatility over time.
Precisely. It minimizes the risk of deploying all your capital at a local market peak. It shows they aren't speculating on short-term price action to make a quick buck.
They have a much bigger plan.
They are making a long-term, calculated bet on the technological infrastructure of decentralized networks. As regulatory frameworks have matured, companies like Bitmain have realized that relying entirely on traditional centralized financial infrastructure carries massive single point of failure risks.
Much like gamers relying entirely on centralized Xbox servers just to open their own front door.
Exactly. They are buying into decentralized networks to build a treasury that isn't dependent on a single bank or a single server farm.
You know, if you are listening to this right now, I really want you to think about how much of your daily life relies on these invisible architectures we've discussed today.
It's everywhere.
From typing a private thought into a Claude AI chat, to the algorithm curating your social media feed, to the custom mods you download, to the Xbox game library you think you own. The core lesson of July 2026 is that we have eagerly traded ownership, privacy, and security for the allure of accessibility and convenience.
You really have.
We are navigating incredibly complex digital systems where something as simple as clicking a share button carries hidden permanent consequences.
And this raises a critical question, something I really want you to ponder as you go about your day.
Yeah.
We just saw a 20-hour outage paralyze millions of gamers globally because a single centralized licensing server failed. As massive corporate entities like Bitmain weave their treasuries deeper into blockchain technology, and as your daily professional productivity becomes inextricably tied to cloud-based AI tools like Claude, what happens when the next 20-hour outage doesn't just hit a gaming console?
Oh, man.
What happens when it hits the very financial infrastructure or the AI networks we are currently rushing to build? Are we carelessly constructing a massive digital house of cards, or is this simply the painful adolescence of a more resilient, decentralized future?
It definitely makes you wonder how solid the ground beneath us really is. Keep questioning the systems around you, keep looking closely at the blueprints, and don't assume the floor will hold just because it's painted to look like concrete. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive, and we'll catch you next time.